On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about how open source is great, but it's not a free lunch either. We talk about how there are some challenges there. Plus, our future is filled with grades of security and trustworthiness, but there may be a downside. Curtis goes into that. Plus, we have a great guest, Jeff Enters, Chief Technologist and Strategist of HPE PointNext Services, and he's going to take us through how you actually can support your remote workforce and also support them when they come back to the workplace. Shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 394, recorded May 22nd, 2020. Remote work, back to work. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. LinkedIn has the targeting tools that can help you focus on reaching your precise audience down to their job title, company name, location, and more. See how LinkedIn can help you with a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit to launch your first campaign. Visit linkedin.com/twit. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at one-fifth the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests and no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com and enter code ENTERPRISE. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own geek in paradise. He's Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, you're always having fun projects down there in the great state of Hawaii. What's been going on this week?
Actually, this week, it's just been trying to close things up, pack things up, and get ready to actually move now that the quarantine in Hawaii kind of looks like it might get lifted enough so that I can potentially cross state lines sometime in August.
Exciting, exciting. Now, are you shipping things, or are you going to take it with you? You're actually going to trek it with a car and a truck and all that stuff?
It's actually going to be a two-stage. One, we're going to have a set of professional movers so that I can get, the heavy stuff done, especially like my data safe and things like that. And then put the house on the market. And then the last bit of, just stuff we use to live day to day. Once the house is sold, that'll go into a pod. And then the car gets shipped to California and we drive across the nation, which ought to be a lot of fun.
Fantastic. New journeys. Well, folks, speaking of experts, we have our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's our senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, always great to see you from the Sunshine State. How's everything going down there in Florida?
Everything's going just fine. We're entering the rainy season just a little bit early, which is giving me time to work on my time travel hobby. So far, I've got the photons delayed by about 2 seconds. We're working on stretching that out a little bit more. But things are going well. The hackers aren't taking any time off for the coronavirus pandemic. There's still plenty for us to write about. And we're seeing a lot more activity around virtual events, which is also keeping me busy. And that's a good thing. People are trying not to be isolated even when they have to be physically separated.
That's right. Well, you're definitely right. The hackers haven't taken time off, especially during this time. And I'll tell you, we had a very busy week in the enterprise, so we should probably get started with all of this because you probably use open source, right? It's really useful. It accelerates your work and your vision, and it gets you the solutions you need right away. However, it's no free lunch either. There are some unintended costs that come with it. We'll get into that. Now, security and trust ratings are proliferate, and is that a good thing? Well, what do you think? I think Curtis has a point of view here, and he's going to take us through it. Now, IT organizations are looking for ways to focus their business priorities. They want to stop spending time on infrastructure and supporting those things. Plus, they want to support their remote workforce. Well, Jeff Enters, Chief Technologist and Strategist of HPE PointNext Services, is going to take us through all the best practices here. But first, it's been a busy week in enterprise news, so let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, we've seen in the last several years, technology is getting smaller. Manufacturers and chip companies are miniaturizing technology and sometimes combining things on one chip. Now, this is definitely the case for Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. They are actually called combo chips, and they're specialized chips that handle multiple types of radio wave-based wireless communication, such as Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, LTE, and others. Now, to increase performance, they actually combine one chip, and they use mechanisms to switch between wireless technologies at a rapid pace. Well, it seems that by combining functionality, it also means that these devices become potentially more vulnerable as well. Now, according to academics from Germany and Italy, they say they have developed a new practical attack that breaks the separation between Wi-Fi and Bluetooth technologies running on the same device. Now, AKA Spectra is a new vulnerability class that relies on the fact that transmissions happen in the same spectrum, and wireless chips need to arbitrate the channel access by taking advantage of the coexistent mechanisms on these devices. Now, researchers analyzed hundreds of Broadcom and Cypress combo chips, which are actually in hundreds of millions of devices, ones that you probably already have right now, like iPhones, MacBooks, and the Samsung Galaxy X series. Now, they found that they can exploit Spectra by attacking a combo chip with malformed wireless traffic and then attacking the chip interface between the two technologies, essentially a denial of service attack. Now, the associated packet meta information allows information disclosures such as extracted Bluetooth keyboard press timings within the Wi-Fi D11 core. In addition, they also identified a shared RAM region, which allows code execution via Bluetooth in Wi-Fi. And this makes Bluetooth remote code execution attacks equivalent to Wi-Fi remote code execution, thus tremendously actually increasing the attack surface here. Now, you might be asking, can you protect against this attack? Can you protect your devices? Well, one way is actually turn off Bluetooth for the time being, which actually reduces the attack surface. Unfortunately, until vendors figure out a way to prevent DDoS attacks on this type of chip, on those common devices or combo devices, they might be vulnerable until then.
Well, two former Salesforce execs are launching a data protection startup. Skyflow, a security startup that employs a zero-trust type of model described by one of its founders as a need-to-know basis for protecting personally identifiable information, emerged from stealth mode this week with a $7.5 million seed funding round. Skyflow, co-founded last year by former Salesforce Vice President of Platform Anshu Sharma and Prakash Kot, the former CTO of Athena Health and former Senior Vice President of Engineering at Salesforce, launched a cloud-based service that uses a group of secure APIs that allow businesses to access and manage sensitive customer data, like social security numbers, credit card information, and healthcare data. Skyflow's platform provides an end-to-end service that includes logging, access control, and data residency or storage, and polymorphic encryption. The service stores the data in secure database vaults and ensures that when the data is shared among applications, only the necessary information is shared and it's anonymized and masked. Skyflow's encrypted database can handle social security numbers and credit card numbers using tokens that are homomorphically encrypted, so internal applications never need access to the real data that's encrypted. This allows a third-party payment process, for example, to check a customer's bank balance without ever needing to see into the account and who it belongs to.
Well, we've been talking about this COVID-19 contact tracing app for quite a while, and it's out. Apple released iOS 13.5 and iPadOS 13.5 for iPhones, iPods, and iPads today. Well, actually yesterday, they went live alongside minor software updates for the Apple TV and HomePod devices. The iOS update mainly adds new health-related features, most notably the much-discussed exposure notification API that was co-developed with Google to help local, regional, and national governments enact contact tracing strategies to battle the COVID-19 pandemic. Usage of the contact tracing API is user optional. Additionally, exposure reports require the user to once again opt into the notification, and it can only be done after the positive result is confirmed by one of the government agencies. Additionally, iPhone and iPad users who rely upon Face ID to access content or services on their devices will find a new simplified process for logging in if they are wearing protective face masks that interfere with the face scanning technology as previously reported. Users of all supported devices will now be able to change group FaceTime call settings so that if a participant is speaking at a given moment, they will no longer cause video tiles to automatically change size. iPhone users in the United States can now choose to share some health information stored on the phones automatically with emergency services when calling those emergency services. Now, it should be noted that contact tracing is also available on Android devices through the Play Store already.
Now, it wouldn't be Enterprise Week without a leak. Now, we all know data breaches have become an increasingly common threat in the recent years. Now, some are nation state-based. Some are just criminals looking for make a buck or expose a secret. Well, over the last 3 weeks, a hacking group called Shiny Hunters has been on a rampage, hawking what claims it close to 200 million stolen records from at least 13 companies. Now, to the dark web, fresh data leaks are like gold, since most posted content today is repackaged data from previous breaches. Now, one interesting thing here is this kind of thing came out of nowhere. This kind of group came out of nowhere, and they were likely a sleeper organization. Now, listen to the timeline here. On May 1st, Shiny Hunters emerged with a sample of 15 million customer data records stolen from the Indonesian e-commerce site Tokopedia. Now, 2 days later, the hackers started selling what it claimed has the full trove of 91 million Tokopedia user accounts on the popular dark web marketplace Empire. Now, on that same day, the group also began selling a trove of almost 22 million user accounts grabbed from the Indian education platform Unacademy. Both companies have confirmed the breaches. In the case of Unacademy, they were saying that the number of affected users is really just around 11 million. Now, what did the hackers get? Well, you know, the usual, like passwords. But the nice thing is they were hashed and difficult to crack. But they also get a treasure trove of information like usernames, email addresses, full names, account creation dates, last login times, phone numbers, and dates of birth. Now, I would say that this is bad, don't you? Wouldn't you? Now, on May 6th, they also have said that they stole 500 gigabytes of Microsoft source code from the company's private GitHub account. Now, the group circulated 1 gigabyte of the data that appeared legitimate, but researchers later concluded that the material was actually largely sample projects and code snippets and templates that would later be just publicized as well anyways. Now, Shiny Hunters went on a terror over the following week, stating that they actually had 10 more sites, including dating app Zoosk, meal kit company Home Chef, design-focused marketplace Minted, Minnesota's Star Tribune newspaper Health and Wellness State Mindful, photo printing service Chatbooks, and web publication Chronicle of Higher Education. Now, though most of the confirmed Shiny Hunter breaches don't reveal plain text passwords, many of the affected sites are still advising that users change their password and their information. Now, if you are using a password manager, you probably wouldn't have this problem because you could just randomize your another password, rotate them often, and the services that you don't necessarily always trust could be trusted.
Well, web scrapers are having a larger than perceived impact on digital businesses. Automated bots that collect content, product descriptions, pricing, inventory data, and other public-facing information from websites have a greater economic and performance impact than many organizations realize. A recent study found bots account for between 40 and 60% of total website traffic in certain industries and can impact businesses in multiple ways, including overloading their infrastructure, skewing analytics data, and diminishing the value of their IP, marketing, and SEO investments. For the e-commerce section, website scraping can dilute overall annual website profitability by as much as 80%, according to a recent study. For the media sector, the median annual business impact of website scraping is as much as 27% of overall website profitability. Organizations routinely use web scrapers to look up information on their competition, to build services based off third-party data, or for a variety of other reasons. the bots scour websites in much the same way search engine crawlers do and collect any information the operator might have publicly posted and would be useful to the organization using the bots. The study shows that while humans and good bots, such as those used by search engines, represented a substantial proportion of web traffic, bad bots represented a significant proportion as well. Nearly 17% of all traffic on e-commerce websites, for example, was comprised of bad bots. On travel sites, proportion was closer to 31%. And on media sites, well, we got lucky, only about 9.5%.
Well, remote work, long-term remote work has, shall we say, changed. And keeping workers productive and secure is now a really big issue. So in less than 2 weeks, our entire work culture shifted. In response to COVID-19 on March 19, 2020, California declared the first statewide stay-at-home order. By March 30, 26 states had joined California, sending millions to work from home. With that, COVID-19 forced companies to make rapid decisions to keep workforces safe and business moving forward. Since that time, companies have plunged headlong into response and survival plans. Immediate concerns were focused on the health of employees and getting them set up to work from home. Security and IT teams worked around the clock to make sure employees had the tools they needed to stay connected and productive. Slack, Zoom, Microsoft, OneDrive, and all the other collaboration apps were rolled out in mass, and if they weren't already part of the work culture, all of this put a strain on security. Suddenly, security was on the hook to manage data risk beyond traditional company parameters and do it at scale. Well, by now, the considerations are coming into focus. While employees are settling into home office routines, companies are focusing on making sure their businesses will keep existing. That may sound dramatic, but it's the same problem that Bob's Coffee Shop, JP Morgan, and a million other businesses continue to ponder. Businesses, as we knew, is not going to be the same. With nearly 100% remote workforce and a world that is socially distancing, how do we keep employees productive and teams innovative while keeping businesses secure? Well, now that our world has changed, workers are now starting to hope much of the remote work options will continue to be available to them. To that end, we're going to talk to our guest, Jeff Enters of HPE Point Next, and the Twiant Gang will look at what our world may look like as the pandemic ebbs.
Now, gaming has become an even bigger component of people's lives with everyone staying home these days. Well, that makes gaming hackers even more stoked about finding ways to exploit the games and services that go along with them. Well, one of the world's most prolific hacking groups decided to surface and target several massively multiplayer online game makers. Now, this made it possible for attackers to push malware-infected apps to their targets and steal in-game currencies of the second victim of the player of the game as well. Now, who is the notorious group? Well, they call themselves Winty, and they have been active since 2009 in this space. They've also been tied to the 2010 hack that stole sensitive data from Google and 34 other companies. Now, more recently, the group has been behind the compromise of the CC Cleaner distribution platform that pushed malicious updates to millions of people. In fact, Winty carried out a separate supply chain attack that installed a backdoor on 500,000 ASUS PCs as well. Now, the most recent attack is a backdoor that was never used before. It's dubbed Pipe Mom, and it installs itself as a legitimate application because it has an imprint of a legitimate Windows signing certificate that was stolen from Nfinity Games during a 2018 hack of the gaming developer. Now, the backdoor, which gets its name from multiple pipes used for one module to communicate with another and project named of the Microsoft Visual Studio used by the developers, used the location of Windows print processors that essentially survive reboots. Now, which game companies did they hit? Well, not much has been revealed just yet, but included several South Korean and Taiwan-based developers of MMO games that are available on popular gaming platforms and have thousands of simultaneous players. What do you think? Could it be Bluehole, the company that makes PUBG? I don't know. I guess this is a major lesson in certificate revocation and expiration. And if an attacker steals your certificate, it may cause havoc on the rest of the world. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have a really great set of topics on our bites. But before we get to that, We have to thank another great, really great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that is LinkedIn Marketing Solutions. All right, let me ask you, where are all the professionals at today? You know, they're on LinkedIn. Right now, the world is changing and businesses are adapting in different ways. And in these uncertain times, how do you make sure your marketing gets the results you need? Well, LinkedIn can help you reach the people who are looking for opportunities to help their business and can focus your campaigns on the objectives for today so your marketing works better. Now, with over 62 million decision makers on LinkedIn, you're able to connect with the right business leaders, people who are there to learn. They want to know how to be more effective at their jobs and find products to help their companies. Now, 71% of people say they use the information they find on LinkedIn to help inform their business decisions. And with LinkedIn ads, you can make sure your messages are getting through to the right people. Now, LinkedIn marketing can help you build campaigns using objective-based advertising, allowing you to customize campaign experience based on the action you want your customer to take, whether you're trying to drive clicks to a website, generate leads, or even generate video views. Now, LinkedIn has the targeting tools that can help you focus on reaching your precise audience down to their job title, company name, location, and more. In fact, you can reach people you already know based on who has visited your site or who you've contacted in the past. Now, LinkedIn ads can help all types of businesses get the marketing results they need. Now, when I post on LinkedIn, I can tell you I get a ton of engagement, especially the people I want actually be engaged. In fact, professionals that I essentially are targeting. In fact, when I posted some of the work that I'm doing on the Office Developer platform, I got a ton of responses. In fact, the session I just did this last week on developer experiences, most of them actually got the info from LinkedIn. That's right. Now, as a podcast network, we have used LinkedIn Marketing Solutions many times for Twit, and we really like how it's able to reach a wider professional audience that ultimately expands our presence. It's great specifically for the fact that once you get onto the platform, you can maneuver the direction of your campaign easily. See how LinkedIn can help you with a free $100 LinkedIn ad credit to launch your first campaign. Visit linkedin.com/Twit. That is linkedin.com/Twit. Terms and conditions apply. And we thank LinkedIn Marketing Solutions for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, if you're an organization that uses web technology like JavaScript, Node, or other platforms, then you're probably familiar with the NPM package managers or the Node packages. Well, packages and other package managers have really become a familiar model for installing software services in open source. Now, there is a treasure trove of value that comes from these open source packages today, especially the ones that bundle functionality from several other packages and you put them together. However, this creates a problem too. If you have a deep hierarchy of dependencies in your packages where packages depend on other packages and one of those has a vulnerability in them, it becomes a difficult task to ensure you patch everything. Now, this is known as transitive dependencies, where a library actually pulls in code from other libraries. It can result in the application relying on code that developers may not know about because they're not explicitly importing that library. Now, more than 80% of applications written JavaScript, PHP, and Ruby import more than 2/3 of their libraries through such a transitive dependency model. Now, if you're using NPM packages in your solutions, you know what I'm talking about, right? Yep, that's right. You do. Now, here's some interesting data. PHP applications, for example, have a modest number of imported open source components at an average of 34%, but a larger share of vulnerability libraries. Now, on the other hand, JavaScript typically has a relatively low number of vulnerable libraries. The typical application has a massive number of imported libraries, on average of 377 on average, and resulting in a large number of vulnerabilities. Now, open source software gives companies tremendous advantages here, but there's no free lunch. And all code must be managed to actually avoid your own contributors, whether open source or not, from exposing users' vulnerabilities. Now, companies like GitHub, they have security services like watchdogs and so on that could assist here. But if you don't take advantage of them or know about them, you could be in the world of hurt. Now, do they fix everything? Not at all. Now, most vulnerability classes are not the ones that developers should necessarily spend the most time eradicating. In fact, 29% of all flaws across site scripting vulnerabilities, but only 8% of flawed libraries have an exploitable version of the vulnerability. Now, two of the other classes of vulnerabilities from the OWASP's top 10 in secure deserialization and broken access controls are more likely to be exploitable, with 30% of flawed libraries having an exploited version of the vulnerability. Now, this really is a case of keeping things up to date, ensuring you have your CI loops that can automate the tasks and ensure the deployments are always have the latest updated dependencies. Now, in fact, I can tell you NPM audit command can actually be your friend here. Guys, I want to bring you in because I think this is a problem with open source across the board. A lot of organizations use open source. A lot of groups use open source. Chibert, I want to throw it to you first because you're a big advocate of usage of open source. Does the risk here outweigh the reward?
You know, it's, you know, six one, half a dozen the other. There's a lot of people that just couldn't be in business if they had to pay for every single library they use, especially the hidden ones that get called by another library or another program. Open source is the way of the world for a lot of businesses. So on one hand, yeah, there's some hidden costs. And the hidden cost is the SysOp. The SysOp has to have enough time and have enough talent to be able to go and try and keep up. And I stress the word try, because I've been trying and trying and trying to keep a lot of my things up to date, and it's sucking up more and more and more of my time. Now, what I would love to see, and this is big wishing, is that I could have apps more like Splunk. I'm going to call Splunk out, because Splunk actually goes and vets all the libraries and pieces that they use. In fact, their installer is monolithic. There are nothing. They don't call anything. It's all in one installer. So that means when I update Splunk, they're also vetting the libraries for me. Will this happen with more apps? Don't know. If you've got enough funding so you can actually develop that, Splunk put an awful lot of effort into things like that. And I don't see that happening in a lot of smaller companies, especially in startups. I keep hoping I'll see more, but I don't know. And this is one of the big reasons why, while I love open source, especially when I was doing a lot of work for the military, we stayed with a lot of commercial pieces simply for the reason that we weren't always sure an enlisted SysOp was going to be able to keep up. We'll see.
I guess we all wish we had the resources like Splunk to be able to write our own stuff and bundle it all together. But like you said, a lot of organizations out there, they just don't have the time and they want to take advantage of the treasure trove of open source that's out there. Curtis, you know, these types of libraries and open source, they make things less expensive to develop. But are we painting ourselves into a corner by not investing enough talent to vet these libraries, you think?
Well, I think the real question, as you point out, is the dependencies. It's one thing to vet a package that we're bringing in, a library that we're bringing in. It's quite another to try and get inside that library, get inside that package, and figure out which other packages it brings in. You know, realistically, you can't do it. I know that there are platforms out there, there's software that will go through and look at all of your libraries and figure out the dependencies. And if you're using open source extensively in an enterprise situation, I think some of these are very good investments, because according to most statistics I've seen, every company out there uses open source software. They may say, oh no, we're completely commercial. But an executive who says that just doesn't understand how development's happening in their organization. A lot of the open source software is quite good, especially the software that comes from the larger, more well-organized projects. It's the little one in two person maintainer projects that really people have to worry about, because they tend not to have the resources to go through and do the kind of quality checking that the large projects make possible. And those are the ones that ultimately can turn out to be that single horseshoe nail, the lack of which caused the battle to be lost.
Right. Yeah, I think you know, like you point out, I mean, a lot of these dependencies are the biggest problem here. And I think there are groups and companies out there that are attempting to help with this. So, you know, even though we might not have the resources to write everything ourselves and bundle it all together, there are companies that are doing kind of scans to try to figure out, you know, where things are being vulnerable, if there's been exploits, these types of things. And so I would definitely, if you're an organization out there that takes on open source or writes your own open source or writes your own software that uses open source, I would say definitely look for some of these services that are out there, these watchdog services, if you like, that basically look through your software and look through your dependencies and find the ones that have already been exploited and attempt to update them. And in fact, they'll tell you when some dependencies have exploits and those packages need to be updated as well. And a lot of these good ones that are out there today, like if you're using the, you know, the React JSs of the world, or, you know, these different libraries that are well used around the world, these groups will most likely keep their packages up to date. And so this way, that whole dependency thing becomes a lot smaller. But again, you got to keep track. You got to keep up to date, and you got to use things that will help scale out the efforts like services. So we'll see how it plays out in the years to come. Well, let's go ahead and jump into the next bite, because we have another really great, interesting one. Now, organizations are looking at a future filled with grades of security and trustworthiness, but there are many downsides there. Curtis, over to you.
Thanks, Lou. Well, in the modern world, we're used to ratings. We're used to test scores. Everything from how we get into college to what kind of credit card we can get depend on personal scores. And now in cybersecurity, a growing number of corporations and organizations are coming out with scores that say that they can help your company figure out how secure your infrastructure, your partners, or even, as we just heard, your software can be. Companies like KnowBefore and InfoSec assign worker grades for how well your employees, for example, perform on phishing simulation, how much risk your employees pose to the employer. Companies like BitSight and Security Scorecard rate companies using external indicators like the security of their partners. More and more companies want some sort of number that they can assign to things like risk. Insurance companies increasingly are demanding that. And as risk and cybersecurity become issues for the boardroom, the members of the board want some nice, firm numbers to assign to risk rather than simply things like, well, we're at threat condition yellow, or we're very, very risk averse. Now, as companies search for ways to limit their risk, a lot of them are wanting to have not just metrics, but a single metric to try and come up with how secure they are. They want essentially a Dun & Bradstreet rating or a credit rating for their cybersecurity. Now, the companies within cybersecurity and risk are responding. Example, last week, NortonLifeLock released a tool called BotSight. And remember, this isn't BitSight, it's BotSight. That rates Twitter accounts on whether they're likely to belong to a real human being or be coming from a bot. A lot of research went into the best ways to boil down all kinds of different indicators, 20 to be precise, into a single score, and they did. Although it's not perfect, I have seen a couple of news pieces this week where the journalist had a little bit of fun with this, because BotSight would occasionally tell them that they were only about 60% human. The key to all of this is making sure that the score reflects reality. We know from harsh experience that companies are placing reliance on numeric indicators, that companies, in fact, are placing far more reliance on numerical indicators than they do on non-numeric indicators. And that can be a problem if those numeric indicators aren't trustworthy. Now, what this means is that you need to understand how any of these systems that you might be looking at come about making up their number. How reliable is the number, or to put it another way, who's watching the watcher? Now, it can be important to use these because they can help you come in and assign your spend on cybersecurity. You want to make sure that where you're spending money is where your risk really lives, and these systems can help a lot with that. So look hard at these risk measuring systems. Look at the numbers they come up with, but make sure you're going into it with your eyes open. Ask lots of hard questions to make sure that the criteria they use is the criteria that's important to you. Lou, I want to come to you first. Have you seen any of these website or security risk ratings in use in the companies around you?
Yeah, I think that the interesting thing here is that we tend, a lot of organizations that we worked with tend to use this data to try to figure out where they need to target, what they need to target next. And I think sometimes that, you know, that is helpful. Obviously, sometimes services can help with providing good touch points and good places to go and put your resources. But I think in the same sense, you also have to go down to fundamentals and target and make sure that you're securing things that you know could be targets, regardless of what the data is showing. And I think what actually these lists and these ratings are showing. I think a lot of times this is being used, sometimes automatically by services. Sometimes they're ingesting this information and using it to go and make, alerting and that kind of thing. So I have seen that organizations are using kind of this type of information. But like you said, you have to make sure that you're focusing on the right things by not putting all your chips in one basket.
Very true. Now, Brian, I want to ask you, when you have looked out into the industry, how good do you think the relationship is between the precision of the number that you're going to get from any sort of rating company and the actual precision of what they can measure? Is this one of those cases where precision and accuracy are two entirely separate qualities for one of these ratings?
I got dragged in to trying to build a security vulnerability score when I was talking to the folks at Ixia and HP Instrumentation and especially Mu Dynamics. And that's it was a real challenge because products are so different, just because of the free market. And having a single score is tough, just as good, hard as our friends at, say, Consumer Reports trying to give a single score for cars or, electric ranges or TVs. It's the same kind of thing. My favorite answer to someone asking, what's the best firewall to buy? It's like, oh, okay, well, that's kind of like asking what's the best car. It all depends on what you're going to do with it. I'm certainly not going to use a Ferrari Testarossa to be able to go take garbage to the dump. It could probably do it, but it's not a good match. And that, I think, is the base problem with a lot of these numbers. Corporations seem to like a single all-encompassing score, which is all fine and good, but it needs to be in context. So to answer that question directly, sure, we'd love to be able to have an accurate number. I think if the field was narrow enough, the concentration of that number was narrow enough, maybe it might be accurate. I was actually in process of trying to build such a thing for home or small business firewalls. And it might have worked, but I was concentrating just on a section of the firewall industry. I wasn't even planning on trying to go into even small enterprise. I was just going to do home and small business. And that alone was a challenge. So directly answering that question, I don't think any of these scores are going to be accurate if they're looking too far, you know, afield. They need to be fairly narrowly focused, and we need to stop and think what those things are trying to measure and use my litmus. Are we trying to use a Ferrari to take trash to the dump?
You know, Brian brings up a great point, making sure that you're using any of these numbers for the purpose they're intended is critical. Now, I've had a chance to talk to people at a lot of these companies, and most of them actually do have a solid awareness of the difference between accuracy and precision, making sure that they are not trying to overpromise with what they do. But still, keeping in mind what they say they can measure and not trying to use them beyond scope is awfully important. Well, we have other important things coming up, including a guest that Brian and I have certainly known for a long time, and we're looking forward to hearing from him. But before we do, we've got another great company to hear from. Lou, over to you.
Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we have a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Before we get to the guest, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, you're already probably storing data right now. It could be on-prem or already in the cloud. Well, think about this. Wasabi is 80% cheaper than Amazon S3 and significantly cheaper than on-premise storage. Now, typically, you can store data in Wasabi's cloud for less than just the annual cost of the maintenance fees on that same data on your on-prem storage. Now, Wasabi's disruptive price-performance model makes buying cloud storage a natural addition. Now, in fact, if you're a managed service provider, Wasabi is a perfect solution for you to sell because you can earn more while charging less. Now, there are two ways people can pay here. You can pay as you go, or you can pay one time with reserve capacity. Now, Wasabi's reserve capacity storage actually makes it buying cloud storage a natural addition to your on-premise storage. And if you're thinking about buying more hardware storage, compare the price against 5 years of reserve capacity storage. You can purchase cloud storage in 1, 3, or 5 year increments and achieve greater discounts for term and capacity. Now, with Wasabi security, it's often even greater than on-premise storage. In fact, it provides 11 nines of durability. And this means on average, you'll lose one file every 649,000 years. You're basically not going to lose a file. Now, hosted in premier tier 4 data center facilities, they are highly secure and fully redundant. Now, Wasabi is secure by default. All data stored in the Wasabi cloud is always encrypted at rest, even if the requesting party doesn't specify encryption. Now, Wasabi follows industry best security models and design practices. They have access control mechanisms such as bucket policies and access control lists can be used to actually selectively grant permissions for people. Now, your data will be immutable. It'll prevent any data from being erased or altered, and you'll be protected from hackers, malware, and even yourself. Now, Wasabi has active integrity checking where all objects stored are checked for integrity every 90 days. And if your organization is worried about compliance, Wasabi's got you covered because they have HIPAA and FINRA and CIJS compliance as well. Wasabi is not just highly secure and disruptive technology that's turning the industry on its ear. It's storage that's 80% cheaper, and it's 6 times faster than the industry leader. Now, if you're looking to reduce your COGS, get all the things you need, including the performance, compliance, and security, go to Wasabi right now. Go build something great. Calculate the savings for yourself and start a free trial of storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial link, and enter code ENTERPRISE. Join the movement and migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Go to wasabi.com and make sure you use the offer code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Wasabi for their support of This Week and Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show where we actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Jeff Enters, Chief Technologist and Strategist of HPE PointNex Services. Jeff, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Hey, Lou, how you doing? Good to see everyone. Thanks for having me on.
See you too. Now, you have a long history with my co-hosts here, so we definitely want to bring them in soon. But before we get to that, our audience really loves to hear people's journey through tech. Can you maybe take us on a short journey and how you ended up at HPE Pointnext Services?
Yeah, you bet. So been on the consulting side my entire career, pretty much. So started consulting back right out of college, and then went over to a company and was director of IT for a while, and then came back to the consulting side. So really been data center side consulting, and then also wireless edge and into large public venues as well for about the past, call it 18 years or so.
Fantastic. Now, we know organizations are trying to keep up. They're trying to digitally transform. They're trying to stay current. What can organizations do from a business lens in this, what you're calling the new norm?
Yeah, fair enough. And I think the question is, when do we find out what that new norm is, right? I think I think we got a little ways to go before we define what that is. So I think right now it's about, and we actually wrote a blog on this. Our SVP and GM, Rohit Dixit, wrote this. So you can go out there and take a look at that. But it's a 9-step model around what this looks like right now. So kind of the immediate crisis management, a few steps there, and then some more steps on the bridge to the new normal. And they can be run in parallel, but it could give companies some ideas on how to, again, bridge the current gap and then look towards the new norm. And that's part of some of the stuff we do with the advisory practice we have within HPE to help customers out and looking at, how they handle the current situation, make sure they continue to operate, keep the lights on, but also look at how they shift possibly even their business continuity management models going forward to address who knows what's coming next, right?
That's right. Well, what's coming next is a lot of people are going remote, right? I think that's what we're seeing is a lot of organizations are trying to keep up with that. What are you seeing? What are organizations doing and what challenges are they seeing from a remote workforce perspective?
Yeah, I think there's a few different things. One, I think it's about looking at both remote work and then back to work. So kind of a little bit of what I was talking about before. So look at what you can do today to get your workers functional in a secure fashion. I think you guys have been talking quite a bit about, increased attack vector in the current situation. So look at that current remote work approach, and don't look at just from a home office, right? I think we have to look at it as a work from anywhere. It could be anywhere. And then the back to work. So what does it look like as we start to bring people back into the office, and how do we stay compliant, of course, but then also how do we make those people productive and feel safe in that environment as they move back into the work or into the office environment possibly? A couple things there.
Right. But the interesting thing is there's a lot of you talk about how making sure we do it for a lot of different scenarios and whether the device is always remote or, whatnot. Are you getting any special requests maybe from different parts of the industry, special types of organizations, maybe like healthcare or so on, when it comes to both remote and other scenarios?
Yeah, definitely. So I think a couple ones that are popping to mind is we actually helped with a cruise ship in Italy that needed to be converted to a hospital with everything that was going on there. So we've got our Aruba volunteer corp that is set up to help with situations like that. So if you're an Aruba Airheads member, feel free to sign up for the volunteer corps as well. What it does is helps with any scenario around the world where there's a company that we know of or a customer that needs help, and how we can get resources out there locally to help them versus any travel and maybe have the person who's the expert remote helping that local person. Mm-hmm. So we're doing things like that. There's of course the pop-up hospitals in the parking lots, the drive-through checks that are going on, and then so how do they wirelessly enable those and get those stood up with the connectivity to be able to, function in those environments? And then also even the big box retailers and some of the grocery stores and things like that, for those to be able to have outdoor Wi-Fi and provide connectivity when people are now standing in line waiting.
Right. Now, you know, as you know, things are starting to get better in some areas. So obviously a lot of the remote workforce is starting to come back, right? And you talked about that a little bit, is making sure you're kind of ready for that workforce to come back from the remote standard. What are you seeing organizations doing? What can they do to be ready for that?
So I think there's a few things. We've kind of laid out about five key areas for us that we're looking at. We've got touchless entry, obviously. So how can I walk in and not have to have any contact on the way in with my badge and things like that? Obviously, fever detection and a number of different ways to do that, FLIR being one of them, using imaging to test for fevers. AR, augmented reality and visual remote guidance is another one. And that applies today as well. We have a solution around that with our HP My Room and visual remote guidance so that you can have a wearable device and be able to perform some work with some guidance kind of over your shoulder, if you will, from remote. And then workplace alerts and information sharing. So if there's something that's been identified, how do you reach out to those employees? I think the big one at the end there is the social distancing, the tracing, tracking side of it. I know you guys have talked about that recently and have some opinions around that. So happy to have some conversations there if you want to as well, because I think that's a big one. And it gets back to what I talked about earlier with giving people the comfort to be able to come back into the office and feel confident that, you know, they can keep their family safe and they're not going into an environment that could put themselves or their family at risk.
That's good ones on the list. So I do want to bring my co-host back in because they have a lot of history here. Cheever, I want to throw it over to you first.
Jeff, you and I have gone back through the Interop program for a long time. And when we first got started, out of access management and trying to tie in a lot of disparate technologies was in its infancy. It doesn't sound like that's the case anymore. In fact, more and more I'm seeing HP involved with tying in a lot of technologies. So people like HPE, Aruba, NetFoundry, Attila, Fortinet, Checkpoint, Microsoft, Stitch. There's a lot of technologies, a lot of moving parts in any enterprise today. What kind of roadmap has HPE been doing to try and make it easier to manage all these moving parts?
Yeah, interesting. So, I mean, I think we're always going to have some challenge across different vendors, right? I mean, you're always going to have some of that. And I think it's going to depend on that specific functional area within the organization, right? Is it campus access, or is it in the data center, what have you? But we've got, there's definitely some really good products that are out there. You think of our OneView product that can really cover a broad spectrum. Our ClearPass product, I think, is real applicable in the current scenario. And that's from the Aruba side. ClearPass is a vendor agnostic security platform that can, you know, really help out in these scenarios, provide BYOD type access, dissolvable clients, things like that. And so I think that starts to help give you some of that cross-platform capabilities. So again, depending on what you're looking at. And then actually the organization that I'm in, our Point Next organization, our advisory and professional services, we help to bring all that together. We even have what's called our GreenLake model for kind of the day to operate and run. So you can have some experts that have the cross-platform expertise to be able to operate on a day-to-day basis.
Super cool. I'm having flashbacks to being interviewed by IBM Global Services. But yeah, super cool. It's almost like what you were doing with us at Interop and tying in a lot of different technologies. There, yep. One of the things that we started narrowing down when we were starting to set up this interview was you had a topic you called OOBM, you know, out of band management. You know, when you and I first started on Interop is UB, just infrastructure. What kinds of out of, you know, when we're starting to talk about reliability, having a way to remotely get in and fix things or upgrade things and all kinds of stuff, what's been changing in the world of out of band management?
Well, I think honestly don't think enough has, to be honest with you. I think it's I'm still seeing too many companies that are leaving it as the nice to have thing off to the side. And I think they're finding out in situations like this that that just doesn't work. And so whether that's think of it as out-of-band management in a data center standpoint, or even some remote field scenarios that a customer might have or a company might have, and be able to access those things, have your experts be able to access those things from remote and ensure that even in these situations where maybe we can't go in physically and we experience an outage, now what happens? How do I get in? Right? Did I save the $50 a month to not have a dedicated pipe coming in for out-of-band management? Did I, you know, do the same kind of thing in remote offices as well, right? Some of those remote offices can have some critical components. Did you do the right thing to have the multiple pass built and set up to be able to have that access at all times? So, you know, there's obviously things like SD-WAN that can help. But what are you doing in those times of crisis when your primaries go down and still be able to get in there and access that? So that applies to, you know, the some of your users as well. You know, I think a question was asked before on some of the challenges I'm seeing. I think companies are not profiling or creating personas, I guess, around their users and the experiences they have to provide. They're putting blanket approaches of, you know, by organization, here's how we're going to enable them. And you really need to think about that a little more granular there and think of what the persona of those people might need.
I do want to bring Curtis in. Curtis, you have a perspective here from enterprise, from security as well. You've seen a lot of different trends out there from workforce, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. And I can think of no one better than Jeff to ask some questions of regarding this. Jeff, you know, we hear on the news stories that basically say that companies have been thrown into this whole work from home environment. And you get the impression that there were companies that were just utterly unprepared. And in your experience, is the issue one of scale, where many companies had small groups that were working from home, but they suddenly had to scale up their work from home? Or were there companies out there that just had not dipped their toe into this at all and had to start from zero?
Yeah, good question. I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's probably more of the former, right? I think it's like most had some form of a solution available to them. It just wasn't ready to scale. And so now they're met with a couple different challenges. They're met with the challenge of, were they relying on a box sitting in a data center, and that was their VPN solution, and it was only set for, to, from a hardware perspective, only able to handle 1,000 users or whatever the number might be. And now they may have only had licenses for 500, but they can only go to 1,000, but they need 10,000. So now it requires physical upgrades and possibly some additional redundancy resiliency, depending on the criticality of the resources connecting in. So I think it's a real eye opener for customers on this, about having that balance of what you need today, having the elasticity to be able to scale up without having the run rate cost there at the same time. What we've found successful is companies are always looking for, like, well, how much is it going to cost me per 100 users or per 1,000 users? So we've actually developed some packages in conjunction with some of our partners, like a Fortinet and a Checkpoint and a few others, to create hardware packages. So Aruba, Fortinet, Checkpoint, whoever it might be, hardware packages aligned with services to be able to quickly enable them in a you know, confined form. So, you know, 100 blocks of 100 or blocks of 1,000, so that they can quickly ramp up and understand what those costs are. But it's all part of that business continuity management going forward as well, right?
Well, I want to dig into that just a little bit, because when you're talking to these companies about issues like licensing and scaling, do you find the conversations revolving around, we've got this temporary situation that we've got to get past, and then we'll go back to what normal used to be? Or are you talking to companies about what could be a very long-term change, you know, that this is perhaps an experiment that they didn't want to run, but now that they are, they're seeing it as an opportunity to change the way they run their workforce going forward?
Yeah, I think without question, for the most part anyway, I think most of the companies that I'm hearing and talking to are understanding that we'll probably never get back to the old norm, right? That there'll always be some form of difference going forward. And so I think they are starting to plan for that. It kind of plays on this theory I have around companies that are in a mode of survive or they're in a mode of thrive. And so are they sitting here trying to just survive and throw some Band-Aids on a current solution to be able to continue to run? Or are they looking to design and plan something that at least gets them running today, but then what's next? What's the long-term plan to have, again, that elasticity? And then also on the thrive side, what am I doing to think about new opportunities that are out there? There's a book I read a while back called Blue Ocean Strategy. And so, you know, looking out there to see what is the art of the possible going forward. So I know a little bit off of your question there, but I think that kind of plays into it of companies, you know, are they really trying to just lock things down? Or are they trying to move things forward?
Hey, Jeff, you mentioned Aruba Volunteer Corps, the Airheads.
Mm-hmm.
Can't let you get away without talking about that. So if we could bring up that website and have you talk about it, that'd be awesome.
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, this is a fantastic initiative by our Aruba team that they put together. So for those that aren't familiar, we got our Aruba Airheads community. So those that know some stuff about Aruba or want to, Aruba Airheads community is fantastic. But then we have the Volunteer Corp. And what that is if you're an Aruba Airhead member, you can sign up for it. And all it is putting in your name, some of your background experience, and then where you're located. I put down, I'm in Chicago. Here's some of my background, maybe some of my certifications. And that way, if something happens in Chicago, as an example, right, if they get a phone call from, Northwestern Hospital downtown Chicago saying, hey, we need some help. We need some Wi-Fi brought out to the venue around the street or around the corner, what have you. They will reach out to volunteers in that area to help deploy. So they'll quickly ship out any gear, bring in some of those volunteers that are willing to help out to be able to do kind of the physical, bring the stuff out there, and then also give them support from remote to be able to bring up that equipment and get that that situation taken care of for that customer.
Well, thank you again for being here, Jeff. We really appreciate your time. We're running a little bit low on time. I do want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where their organization go to learn more about HPE and how they can get started.
Yeah, you bet. So thanks guys for having me on the show. There's a blog that I wrote recently with my VP, Sadat Malik. So it's called Last Mile Challenges with Remote Work. So feel free to go out there and take a look at that. You can reach out to us. Got our handle there for Twitter at HPE_point_next. Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be working on our HPE Discover show. So we've got our Discover virtual experience that's coming up, wide open to anybody that wants to join, and we'll be donating $10 in that effort if you come to the show. So, you know, come to that show. I'll be out there. We're going to be trying out this new virtual experience way of doing this, but we'll have some live interactive stuff going on as well, some great demos for folks to be able to show them what's going on. And I think it'll be a really good interactive experience in this virtual environment. So, yeah, thank you, guys.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe. So resist the urge. Start playing us during your virtual social hour, too. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
I am on Twitter at ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or I am Chibert at twit.tv, but better yet, why don't you use Twiet at twit.tv, and that email will hit all the hosts. And by the way, Chebert is spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T. My students and I had a Dilbert theme for naming our servers.
Thanks, Chebert. Well, we also thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on with you in the coming week, and where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, after the holiday on Monday, I'm going to be writing and talking to people at for stories that I'm writing at Dark Reading. So come on over to darkreading.com and especially look at the edge of Dark Reading. I tend to have a lot of pieces there. I'll be tweeting about those in my my account there at KG4GWA on Twitter. And you might also check out in mid-June, June 17th, I'm going to be taking part in a virtual event at Dark Reading. I'm going to be leading a panel on how to know if you've been compromised, getting into a little bit of the best and worst ways to find out you've been compromised. It's part of an all-day event that we're doing virtually. Come on over. It's free. Sign up, and I'll look forward to seeing you in my session.
Thanks, Curtis. Appreciate you guys being here. Well, folks, I also want to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to get your enterprise and IT news for the week. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/twit. There you all find the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, and, of course, the links to of the stories we do during the show. But, of course, more importantly, next to those videos of your choice, you'll actually be able to support our show by subscribing and getting your download of your choice, and support the show by getting your audio version, your video version, your HD video version. And you can listen on any one of your devices. In fact, you can choose it from our any one of your podcast applications as well. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. And we'd love you to share that with you. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family, your coworkers by sharing the gift of Twiit with them. And if you already subscribed and you're available these days around 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays, we do the show live. You can check it out at live.twit.tv. We're on the stream right now. And you can come see how the show is run, come see behind the scenes, how the pizza's made, and all the banter and fun we have here at Twit. Plus, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room as well. That's irc.twit.tv. We love chat room. We have a really great set of characters in there. They provide some really great content and different directions during the show. So definitely jump in there and join them. Now, if you're going to watch the show live or you can't watch the show live, but you still want to be part of the amazing community we have here on Twit and Twiit, come join the 24/7 discussion on our new community location, twit.community. The community has some great discussions on the shows, on the content of the shows, maybe just technology topics, all types of stuff going on out there. The guests, the co-hosts are out there. Come join the community at twit.community. Of course, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. Love having followers. Now, I actually post all my enterprise tidbits out there. Of course, all the conversations that I love having with you are done out there as well. Plus, you can see what I do during my normal work week. I post some stuff there as well. If you want to check it out as well, what I do, you can go to developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post the latest and greatest ways you can customize your office experience to make it more productive for you. Also, we just did Build. Go check out all the content. It's great. Build.microsoft.com. There's some great content, free content out there, all the latest and greatest technologies out there for you to check out right now. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Lee Only. So they continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we could not do this show without them. So thank you for all their support. Of course, thank you to all the engineers and all the staff at Twit. Of course, we want to thank Mr. Brian Chee, one more time. Chebert, he's not only our co-host, but he's our tireless producer as well. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show. And we really couldn't do it without him. So thank you again, Chebert, for all your support. And of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Jeff. Jeff, you are here each and every week. Are you still there in the studio alone?
Yes, all by myself today. The hallway's dark. I'm the only one in here. So I got to be dark, my own engineer and the TD. It's great, though. Love it.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Jeff, for being here. And we'll love having you, and we love having you next time, too, if you could be here next time.
Absolutely.
All right.
I will thanks, be here.
Jeff. Fantastic. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiit.
Hey, folks, I am Micah Sargent, co-host of Tech News Weekly right here on the TWiT Network. Yes, Tech News Weekly is a show we do every week, Jason Howell and myself, where we talk to people who are making and a breaking the tech news. That's right. It's journalists, it's inventors, it's app makers, it's everybody who's bringing the tech news in a given week. It's all the stuff you want to know about in bite-sized chunks in a fantastic package. So be sure to subscribe. It's twit.tv/TNW.